did you know that in India, they call kisses that are blown flying kisses? So I'm sending flying kisses out from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop. This is Ink and Worm. My name is Swan. And that kind of reminds me of the monkeys, the flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz. And I am excited about our show today. We are talking with Michael MSG Stewart. He has a show, Collision Time Revisited, celebrating all things punk. And that was the Ramones from his show, but also from the Ramones. And so if you're into that, you can check him out. We're here today talking about his book. He published a book called I Am the Angel in 2004-2009. And we're going to move right into it because we have his friend and editor on the line as well, and we want to be able to talk to her about what's going on. Let's check our levels. How is everyone today?
I'm good.
You're good?
I'm doing fairly well.
Awesome. I also have my brother in town, so he's going to be joining us. He read the book and is a fan. It made us both laugh, and so we're excited to talk about it. Taryn, are you there? Can you hear us? I don't hear her. Can you hear her?
I hear nothing.
We were having some technical difficulties and even talking to her, so it's a little bit sad. We'll see if we can get her on the line. Can she hear us?
Can you hear us?
I don't hear anything. Uh-oh. Maybe it's not.
Ruh-roh.
I know. What's happening? Okay. Taryn, can you hear us? Hello? I don't hear anything.
Oh.
Maybe. Was that it?
I heard something.
I heard a scratch. Oh, shucks, golly. This is annoying. Well, I guess if we can't hear her, that kind of defeats the purpose of having her call in. So let's let her go. Do you want to say goodbye?
Hi. Can you hear us now, Taryn?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, hey, that might work. Hi, Taryn. This is Swan. So nice to meet you. We're going old school. Thanks, Michael. Problem solving. We've got a speakerphone next to the mic.
This is all about DIY.
Yeah, we make it work. I just was actually hoping to talk to you really quick and asking if you could share your experience with Michael's book, I Am the Angel, as you were a huge factor in editing and getting it ready for publishing. I was hoping you could just kind of share your experience.
Sure. I will recall it to the best of my abilities. It was a few years ago that I worked on it. But I actually worked with Michael in a professional capacity and had been working for many years as a managing editor in an advertising agency that we worked at together. And so I guess I brought the editing skills to the table from that perspective. I guess I got the manuscripts when it was pretty fully baked. And Michael, I don't remember what the word count was or how many chapters off the top of my head, but
it's about, it's like just under 100,000 words.
Oh.
Okay. So I actually took the manuscript, and I worked on it over a series of weeks. And I think that what we did, if I remember correctly, was I did sort of, I don't know, I took kind of a traditional editorial process with it. And on the first round of editing, I did what I would describe as a pretty heavy copy edit, major proofreading, but then I also just read it for sense. Mm-hmm. So making sure that the tenses were accurate and, you know, that he wasn't talking about an experience in chapter 11 that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, back in chapter 2 or vice versa. And that took a fair amount of time. I was, I think, lucky because the timing was great for me. I was actually in the process of relocating from New York City to Denver at that period of time. And so I was, I had a few weeks right between gigs, and so I just kind of focused on that manuscript. And so I think the first round was the one that I spent the most amount of time on, and I know that I sent all of those changes back to Michael. And I believe, I'm trying to remember, it was such a long time ago, that I know in my initial markups I did everything by hand. I actually read the manuscript in paper format, and then I went back into the electronic version and made all the edits. And I think that, Michael, if I remember correctly, that's pretty much how he worked for the next few rounds. I think we did three rounds of edits, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think we did two, because I remember... Okay. Yeah, because I remember coming up to you, and the way that I managed to hook Taryn in is, as Taryn mentioned, we worked together at this advertising firm, and Taryn was my favorite editor, and I'm not just saying that because she's on the line here. And I just went up to her after our team's morning meeting and said, I have a business proposal for you. Mm-hmm. And she said, great. And I told her that, I mean, what I offered to pay her was – it was well below market rate because, you know, I just couldn't afford that much. But apparently it was more than she expected. So she agreed to do two rounds, which was a very pleasant surprise.
Yeah, and I'm sure it helped clean up.
It did, yeah.
Yeah.
We all need help.
Yeah. I mean, I came to her because – and we'll – probably get into a little more in depth when we talk about the self-publishing process, but I really was looking for a copy edit, basic, what we call sense and spell, tense and spelling and everything. And she surprised me by going a little more in depth, going above and beyond that with looking at the sentence structure of a lot of things. And she had a lot of suggestions in that regard. Mm-hmm. And some I took and some I didn't. And some I didn't take her exact suggestion, but I kind of used that to sort of reevaluate the way that I had framed them and did my own way. So it was incredibly helpful.
Great. What was your personal experience with the book, having seen it in kind of more raw format? This question's for Taryn. More like raw versus the cleaner, after it was polished, because very few people see that all over the place first couple drafts where there's a lot that needs to be changed or altered. Does that question make sense?
Yeah, so I would say this was my turn to be surprised. I didn't really know what Michael would be handing over to me. I he was a writer, but I really had no idea what to expect. And like he said, I mean, I did do a little bit of a deeper edit in terms of, looking at sentence structure, things like that. But the storyline was there. It was super solid. The characters were really well developed. And the story arc was there. And from beginning to end, I felt like it was threaded really well. And it was clear to me that he, had spent a lot of time on it. And I was surprised that he hadn't had another professional editor really working on it at some point. So, I don't know how it works in a lot of other self-publishing processes in terms of whether or not, it's a really big chopped up mess or not. But, I thought that it was pretty well done and put together. And Michael, I don't remember how much time you had already spent at that point. I mean, you've been writing it for a while, right?
Yeah, I started the initial manuscript. I actually started it in 2002, and I finished it. I mean, the first draft took 6 months, and then I did two more passes, and that took another 6 months. So I finished that in 2003, and I kind of set it aside for a really long time for various reasons, part because I made some employment transitions, and there was a period of unemployment or two. So it was in 2008 was when I decided finally I want to pick this back up.
Nice.
Yeah.
I know one thing I was really struck by was I was pretty surprised by the ample development of the female characters. I mean, not to sound sexist or anything, but I was really surprised by it. I thought there was a lot of significant detail, particularly in the female characters around sort of just how they were operating in the storyline. And it was clear that there was a lot of thought put into them. I remember wondering if they were based on real people, if he'd sort of taken experiences from real life and built those in. So,
Well, the interesting
talk about that.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the female characters, I mean, like there's three major ones, and like I think one or two supporting ones. I think they are, I think, by far the most interesting characters in the book. I mean, like the main character is a man, but the there's the female lead and like two of the supporting characters, the two who don't show up until like about 2/3 of the way through the book, like, are definitely my favorite characters, and it was really. Especially Marley, who's the female lead character, her character develops a lot, and it was like really fun to work on that. And the other two, Sashiel and Lyra, they're just awesome. I love them.
Yeah.
they were so much fun to write.
They're a riot.
Yeah.
Taryn, do you have any other thoughts you want to share before we let you go?
Can I just say like one thing before Taryn goes?
Yeah.
So when Taryn worked together, I think one of the reasons, and like I've heard this from other people, I am a project manager. You know, like I don't work professionally like in a writing capacity, at least not yet. So I think that's why Taryn was probably surprised that like I was like, hey, I wrote a book.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I wasn't surprised that you'd written a book.
Okay,
I wasn't expecting a fully formed, I mean, the, like I said, the concept was formed into a full storyline, and so it was great. The only thing I guess I'll add is I think from the editing perspective, I had not edited a book or a copy of this length before, and I did the first pass in a really tight setting. I think that it just spoke to kind of the story itself. It was very engrossing, and so I wasn't sort of fighting my way through it like I might with advertising copy. So it was. I felt kind of fortunate that was the experience I had with a book of that length. And I think, you know, it would be interesting to. You should write another book, Michael.
I just might.
More stories to
All
tell.
All right. Well, let me know if you guys have any other questions.
Yeah. And Taryn, are you still in advertising or can people come to you with projects?
So I work in nonprofit now.
Oh, nice.
And I still work in communications. I do freelance work occasionally. And yeah, absolutely. People can feel free to reach out to me if they're interested in having me, you know, come to their side from the editing perspective.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for letting us call in and for being here to give us a different perspective on the book.
Sure thing. Thank you, guys. I look forward to listening to the full radio show.
Yeah. Yay.
Here, here. Thank you so much, Taryn.
Happy Sunday.
Sure thing. Take care, guys.
Happy Bye-bye. Sunday.
Bye.
Oh, yay. That was one of our surprises, and it worked out despite the odds, I guess you could say. So let's talk a little bit about your book. There probably will be spoiler alerts, so if you haven't read the book, hopefully it's just like teaser information to read it. Uh-huh. It was very good, and I would recommend it to anyone. I think this is kind of like a beyond genre, so it fits under fantasy because it's like...
Yeah.
But it's almost like... I think that there's so many characters that anyone could read it and they would resonate with somebody or some part of the story.
Yeah, there was a genre that I came across and I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was called magical realism. So like just like a combination of those different factors. And as I think I was mentioning this before the show, I think an influence on my writing is Kurt Vonnegut. And I didn't sit down and say, like, I want to write a book like Kurt Vonnegut, but that's something that I've been exposed to that was kind of inspiring for me. And also another one is Christopher Moore, who I had not read at the time, but I read him like after I'd finished the book and thought, like, this is actually exactly the kind of writing that I want to project. And they both work within fantasy genres, but also their work is heavily satirical. So I think that's kind of what I was going for.
What came out.
Yeah.
So the premise of the story is a man dies suddenly. That's the first chapter is him looking down at his dead self. and an angel.
Bloody corpse.
Yeah, and an angel saying, okay, are you ready to go? And throughout the course of the story, it's just like, oh gosh. I mean, part of me wants to read the synopsis, the back of the book, but he just kind of goes to heaven, and it's like this, I mean, it's all speculation, but we're all human, so we all wonder what happens after you die. But it's like, okay, this is what heaven is, and by the way, we want you to be an angel and help other people. And so he goes to angel school, and it's really funny because he's the type of guy that's like, school? I hated school. I don't want to go back to school. Now, like, now I'm dead and I have to go back to school.
What kind of heaven is this?
Yeah, what is this? But it's just the process of him navigating that that path and navigating the relationships that arise from that path and kind of consolidating loose ends, I guess, from his life and things that he hadn't finished processing. Without giving too much of the plot away, any thoughts to add? Any pivotal points?
I thought it was, and this may be a weird thought, but I thought it was a source of hope in a way that all of us sinners can still go to heaven, because there were a lot of controversial subjects and people in it that it's like, they got into heaven? How? Why? This person didn't get into heaven. How? Why? And it made me think like, huh, maybe I'm not going to hell.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's involved so much with sin, but I know that the main character, he carries a lot of hatred. And I think one of the points, and like in This Is Made, is that they're able to discern who is a bad person and who is an intrinsically good person who has committed various bad acts in his life. I think another character is a character named Suzanne. Who, and I don't think this is giving too much away, is like another one of the angel trainees in the class with him. And she is the kind of person who realized, who was very shallow when she was alive, and towards the end of her life came to regret the person that she was. And one of the reasons that she's so enthusiastic about becoming an angel is because she wants to make up for like all the bad things or like the bad behavior that she has done in her life.
Yeah, and I really liked the main characters brought to heaven, and they're like, we think you're generally a good person, but we also don't really have a lot of, like, stuff to go on. Your life was just kind of
blah.
Meh.
Yeah.
So we're giving you this opportunity to, like, tip the scales one way or another.
Yeah.
I kind of like that because, and especially with one of the characters, how she was given a pretty heavy life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like this nice understanding that you're dealt a set of cards and that any divine, you know, entity is going to take that into consideration.
Yeah. That's how you react to your situation, not the situation you're placed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you talking about Marley?
Yeah. She had a pretty heavy life starting up, and she died under really, I guess, questionable circumstances without giving too much away.
Without giving too much away. I mean, the idea, it's said really early on that she, that she was a junkie, she was a heroin junkie in her life. And the way that that developed was, I just decided, and Mike, maybe we'll get into why later, that I wanted one of the characters, his fellow students in the angel training class, to be a heroin addict. And
it just happened.
Yeah.
Happened to be her.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. And I had to think about, like, how would somebody with the heart of an angel, become a heroin addict? And I thought it made sense that it would happen through a very tragic life. And that's why, the events in her life that I wrote about transpired that way.
Yeah. One more question, and then we'll do a quick break. I'm curious where this started, because it's always a process of connecting dots. But where did this story first start for you?
I saw this movie called Bless the Child, which is a movie that I don't think anybody remembers but me. And it was, it's about this little girl who is destined to become the next Christ figure and this cult leader who is trying to control her. But it is, it's not like a Christian movie by any stretch of the imagination, but like there is a heavy theme of spirituality that goes throughout this film. And one of the leitmotifs that they go through is they make use of angels in the film. Mm-hmm. And the way that angels are presented, you know, like it's not people in white robes, not people with, you know, like halos and wings. It's just these people who appear and they either do something or they say something helpful and then they leave. And I found this concept very fascinating. So I decided that, see, I had just written a story which ended up getting published by an online publication. So I kind of felt like I was riding high and I wanted to write another story. And so I said, this is my next story. I'm going to write a story about angels.
Uh-huh. Cool.
That's something I liked in the story or in the book is that there was these conversations that would just like, that's kind of the work of an angel in a lot of ways was just to create these conversations that would help someone shift their path. Do you have like, I'm thinking about conversations that potentially did that for me, or people that potentially did that for me. Was that seated in your personal experience or that was just something that you pulled from the movie?
Not really. I mean, it was, I guess like something that I pulled, but I think the idea is if you kind of look at some various definitions of what angels are supposed to be, they are supposed to be inspiring and give people guidance. And the idea of the quote-unquote guardian angel is not something that I really explore. It's more about you're kind of like they do things on the spot. You know, like they help people at either crisis moments or pivotal moments and give them that little push in the right direction, either something that they intrinsically want to do or are afraid to do or are just, you know, restricted by fear in general or really don't know the path that they need to put themselves on.
Yeah. Or one character, for him, it was just a process of being like, stop blaming yourself for something you had no control over.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, pretty much was life or death circumstances for him. And an angel comes in and is just like, you didn't choose that.
Yeah.
Stop beating yourself up for it. And so, it's more important than I'm letting on. But I like that, you know, I think we all have our friends that call us back from the crazy sometimes or just like help you balance out the reality versus what you're creating in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that to be the job of an angel seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah. I think I was actually very unhappy when I wrote the book and I didn't really have anybody in my life to, you know, like kind of help me through that. And also I was sort of hesitant, and this is reflective in the main character, to seek out help because I didn't want to burden people with my problems.
Yeah.
And maybe that was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. I also love, I can't pronounce their names, so I'll let you pronounce them, but there's two angels that are very unexpected personalities.
Oh my God, I love them. Yeah.
I love them too.
I think I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Say their names again.
Sashial and Lyra.
Sashial and Lyra. so great. I think I'll have to go back. I have pages folded. But they are the sailors of the angel world in terms of vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Yeah, they are, as defined, like they are the angels of adverse adoration, which is just a fancy way of saying they embody the representation of tough love.
Yeah. lots of swearing, lots of what the hell are you doing? Stop fucking up. You'll never get anything right.
Mm-hmm.
Verbal slaps in the face. Yeah.
From angels.
Yeah. Yeah. Lyra is very mean and very snide and condescending. And Sashiel is very loud and curses a lot. So like they're slightly different, but means to the same end.
Yeah. Sometimes people need that.
Yeah.
Like main character needed that. You're listening to Ink and Worm. I'm your host, Swan. I'm on all of the things, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, either Ink and Worm or Swan Drishti, my name. Please reach out. Let me know what you think. Also, a couple personal plugs. I'm going to be starting a donation-based yoga class and also starting a river riding class. I'll talk about that more as things become more solid. But if you're interested in that, reach out to me and I'll make sure to keep you posted. question I had for you is, we had a conversation and you mentioned that the only book you've ever read about writing was Stephen King's On Writing.
I don't know if that's the only book that I ever read. I mean, I had to read various composition books when I was in college, but the Stephen King book was the only one I think I read on my own, and that was extremely inspiring.
Yeah, so I've read it, most of it. I want to ask if you – so he's – Stephen King in his book On Writing is talking about the book The Green Mile. The Green Mile? I might be remembering that wrong because my brain is foggy. He talks about how he really hoped that the main character would make it out alive, but he didn't know how that was going to happen, and he might have to kill him. Mm-hmm. Did you get that sense when you were writing some of your characters of like, I don't know what's going to happen to them, and I hope that it turns out okay, but I don't know how that works?
Yeah, I really had no idea when I started what was going to happen to the characters. One of the
Did you have a personal attachment to any outcome, or it just kind of happened?
It just kind of happened. Is the one of the things that Stephen King writes about is a concept of what he calls unearthing the fossil.
Mm.
And the way that he explains it is the author doesn't find the story finds the author. Mm-hmm. So the author's job is to start with your basic premise. So you're not really supposed to, at least like not in his experience, have an entire story fleshed out when you sit down to write. You kind of start with your premise and you start with your characters and the story. I mean, your premise is kind of like that little piece of bone in the fossil that's sticking up out of the ground. So the author is not creating this fossil. What he's doing is he's unearthing it. He's removing all the dirt away and letting it present himself. Mm-hmm. So
this makes me think of Michelangelo carving the David, where he's like, how did you carve this beautiful statue? And Michelangelo says, I didn't think it out. I didn't plan it. I just carved away everything that wasn't the David.
And so I had this marked in his book, and I'm going to paraphrase a lot, but he does say, you know, he talks about having your toolbox as a writer to get the fossil out of the ground as intact as possible. But I love, because pretty much if you go to a writing class, they're going to talk about plot. And that's the first thing they're going to talk about. And he's just like, plot is the jackhammer. You cannot unearth a fossil with a jackhammer. It's going to come out. You're going to do as much damage as good. So the plot's kind of just like, he's like, plot is, I think, the good writer's last resort and the dullard's first choice. The story which results from is apt to feel artificial and labored. And I kind of agree with him, because when I do go to writing classes or anything and they're just like, what's the plot? What's the plot?
Uh-huh.
It's like, I don't know. And it makes me also think of, I went to Talking Illustration with Maria Popova and two French children's book writers, and they talked about how they never envisioned the story being specifically for children. They just were telling a story. And then it was the publisher that was like, oh, this is for kids. So I think just like, tell the story. Stop trying to like make a plot work, because it feels artificial.
Yeah. I mean, I remember in various composition courses that I took in college, they would say, have your outline, start with an outline. And, you know, like I read Stephen King's book. And so, like, I didn't have a story when I sat down to write it. You know, like, I just had, I mean, I didn't even really had a premise. Like, I had a title. Now,
I'm Angel.
Yeah, that was literally, like, all I started with.
You started with the title. Did you start with the first chapter being him dying?
Yeah.
So, in your journey, how much did the book change from first draft to final?
First draft, I mean, the plot is basically... was basically entirely intact, like, after I finished the first draft. The second draft was basically just filling in plot holes,
mm-hmm.
and the third was cleanup. And both, like, as much, you know, like, spelling and grammar as much as I could, and mm-hmm. also I literally, like, I put out a flowchart of, like, the chronological order and tried to see, you know, like, are these time frames that they're speaking about, like, actually correct? And, like, and that was very... I actually spent a lot of time on that.
And so you went over your manuscript three times before you gave it to Taryn?
Yeah.
Nice. That seems like a reasonable amount. I haven't written a book.
Mm-hmm.
You said you wrote something and had it published. Was that article or short story, or was that?
Yeah, it was a short story.
And so this was the first long thing you were.
Yeah, and I actually sat down to write another short story. I did not sit down with the intention of writing a novel. It just kept on getting longer and longer and longer, and before I knew it, I had maybe 10 chapters written, and I wasn't even anywhere near the end of the plot. So yeah. It just kept getting bigger and bigger.
And, oh gosh, my brain just left. I had another question, but it's not there anymore.
I have something to say. Whenever I read fantasy books that are based in our world, I always look at, like, how are they covering this up in the world? How do humans not notice this? Mm-hmm. And I liked how subtle the interactions between angels and humans were in this book, because it is very easy to accept, like, yeah, we could miss that very easily. Like, there's no great explosions or memory wipes or anything like that. It's just subtlety and thinking things through.
Conversation and relationships. And certain angels have certain gifts, which I found really intriguing, because that's a big thing. So two questions. The first, have you read through the book since you published it?
I don't think I've read the entire thing all the way through. I mean, I have sat down and read various passages,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it's a narcissistic thing, but like there are scenes that I just love revisiting.
Yeah.
And that also happened while I was writing it. I mean, like I mentioned that there were a few like long gaps before, you know, like when I sat down and put it aside. There were a few scenes that I loved reading so much that every time I would read it, I would make a little change or like add a little something.
Uh-huh.
And I think one of those scenes I'm going to talk about without giving it too much away, which is when the angel Lyra shows up in the main character's apartment in heaven.
Uh-huh.
That is my favorite scene, and I read it so many times. And like one of the things that I think makes it, I don't want to say so great, or at least like that I love it so much, is because I spent so much time working on it, and I kept on like adding these pieces and these little details.
Is this later when he's naked and she's like, "You're an angel. Why are you putting clothes on? You can just like zap them on."
Yeah.
Okay.
You know? And when she's saying like why do humans like have to hold themselves back? You know, and she's like, "You're the worst I've ever seen."
This is tough love.
Yeah.
It seems like there was a big theme of Christianity potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like just the influences of your life being manifest, or was that intentional?
I think it's the sort of mythology behind the book is rooted in basic Judeo-Christian mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because, I mean, like, that's my experience. Like, that's what I knew. But
yeah.
I also try to stress, I think it's mentioned at the end, which is, this is not too much of a spoiler.
Your heaven is your heaven.
Yeah. Your heaven is your own heaven. And, like, there's other cultures which will not be reflected in your own experience,
yeah.
but, you know, like maybe reflected in somebody else's.
And I almost wish that there was more of that. It wasn't necessary to the story, so it wasn't something that should have been included. But I almost was like, it got my head spinning of like, interesting. Well, what would it be like if I were to be like, I'm going to go step into this other person's heaven?
Mm-hmm.
And like, what does that look like? So
that
anyways.
Could have been an interesting contrast.
Yeah.
The basis
yeah.
of it was like, you see what you expect to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what would happen if
a
Christian, like heavily Christian guy were to just walk into like Valhalla on accident?
Or
like oops.
Yeah. The Hinduism with all the...
Yeah. Well, the I think gods. It mentions like when he first steps into heaven,
uh-huh.
that when he's guided by the Archangel Michael, who is the angel of death, he can see other people walking around, and Michael tells him they don't see what you see.
Yeah.
No.
He saw New York.
Yeah.
That was his heaven.
That's his ideal life.
I love
yeah.
Maybe you wrote it. I love there's this scene. He's like, "Look, do you see the Jersey Shore?" And he's like, "No." He's like, "Yeah, it's the way it should be."
Yeah.
Now New York is perfect.
Yeah.
I was like, aw. But
yeah. And another reason, like, there is It is so heavily rooted in, like, Judeo-Christian mythology, I guess, because I was including, like, all these characters, and I don't know, I felt compelled to, I guess, like, this is, I mean, I don't want to say it's true because, like, it's mythology, but at least the one that people are used to and, like, something to, like, draw inspiration from. So that's why there's so many, like, most of the characters who are archangels, like, are based on the mythology, like, of the archangels that, and I did a whole lot of research into stuff from the Bible, stuff from the Apocryphas, and, like, some stuff from other sources. So, like, you know, like, Michael is a character, and Gabriel is a character, and I think Aniel is the teacher, and a few other make appearances. I mean, the only archangels I made up completely were Sashiel and Lyra.
Speaking of the archangels, I was really curious, like, you make mention at one point in your book, which made me really happy, about Lucifer, but he never shows up anywhere else in the book. Uh-huh. I was curious, while reading the book, is he still in your world out there somewhere doing his thing, trying to change hearts, or is it just the natural evil and bad thoughts that humans naturally have that angels are fighting against?
Lucifer he's down in hell.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's not something that I've explored too heavily. I mean, like, my way of thinking of it, because, you know, like, I do have an idea of a follow-up, and, like, and it actually involves Lucifer in hell. And so, like, he is kind of hell's overlord. And he is, I guess, if you would say, if, like, I don't know if anybody remembers Dungeons and Dragons, you know, like, there are various forms of evil and chaotic evil, and there's actually something called lawful evil, which I think it's defined as something being, you know, like, I'm very level-headed, but
he's organized.
Yeah, is organized, and, like, there's means to the end. So, like, you know, he's not the kind of creature who would go around killing people, but he kind of
has a master plan.
Yeah. He has a master plan. He knows what he wants. The basic, you know, like, the zygote of the idea is he is like, there's a new character. Actually, the crystal blue eyed girl who, I don't know if you remember, like, who's in only one scene, like, would factor in heavily into, like, into the follow-up.
On the subway?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And there's going to be, like, a battle for her soul. So Lucifer thinks that he has a claim to her. And
So you are writing another book.
No, I have this idea. I mean, like, I'm working on something else right now, but maybe when that's done, like, I'll start that up again.
Another writing project?
Yeah.
Nice.
I'm currently working on a film treatment.
Ooh.
Yeah, just like a spec treatment, but something, an idea that I had that I couldn't live with myself if I didn't flesh it out some way.
Nice. I really like one of your characters. You have quite a few. I really like the mix of characters that you included in his angel class.
Uh-huh.
And there's one character, Roy, who's like a holier-than-thou type persona. And that was his big transition to being an angel, is to, like, find humility rather than, like, because I'm following the rules, I'm better than you.
Yeah, he really thinks he's better than everyone because he felt that because he's a deep religious person that he had faith in his life. And so when he gets to heaven...
And a lot of judgment.
Yeah, very judgmental. And he gets to heaven and he finds out that... And, like, he's told that faith is good, but religion isn't entirely, like, a man-made creation.
Yeah.
Like, I think my favorite way that it was described is he had a holier-than-thou perspective of life.
Which is said to be kind of ironic for an angel.
Speaking of holier than thou, there's a lot of really nice puns that happen too with that.
Uh-huh.
Was those, like, things that you just thought about and then found a way to weave them in the story, or did they just emerge?
They just emerged, you know, stuff that popped in. Yeah.
Yeah. It was really great.
Yeah.
I spent
a lot of time working on the language. You know, it's, you know, very important that, you know, you don't repeat yourself.
Yeah.
You can't use the same words over and over again. It's just like it just creates a very irritating writing experience.
And different characters are going to have different vocabulary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, Marley's vocabulary,
And this was actually very tricky. Marley's vocabulary was deliberately kept very simple because, like, she is a person, like, she grew up with really without any schooling. You know, like she was, like, homeless for, like, most of her, like, you know, like most of her teenage life.
Yeah.
And, like, and post-life. So, like, I think in the beginning when, you know, well, I think when the main character is talking about college and he asks, like, did you go to college? And she said, I didn't go to high school. You know? Mm-hmm. So, like, I had to make sure that she came across as somebody, you know, like, who was smart but uneducated.
Yeah, I think you did that.
Yeah.
So in street smarts.
In speaking of the characters, how much was based on people that you knew and how much was just imagined using...
I think most of it was imagined. I mean, the main character, and it's very obvious to anybody who knows me and has read it, is based on myself.
Yeah.
Sort of like, you know, like very, the extreme, like, heightened versions of myself, like me at my worst end, me at my best. And the other characters, Marley just came out of this idea of, you know, like the tragic life and the heart of an angel. There's a little bit of Carrie in there. Carrie was a book that was a big influence.
Yeah.
Like Carrie, I had read Carrie, and then I read Stephen King's writing book.
Uh-huh.
And the writing book, which is part autobiographical. And so he talks about the writing of Carrie and how that manifested himself. And so I guess sort of like the quiet but subtly powerful person came about. And the other characters was I just, you know, I guess wanted to come out of diversity.
Yeah.
And personality-wise, I think the only one that I can think of that was based on a person is, and, you know, like, the name is actually escaping you. I think Raphael, when he sees, like, Raphael, who's the angel of science, who has, like, a very odd
who makes
manner.
Jokes. Yeah.
He was based on a neurologist that I saw.
When, oh, my.
Yeah, when I had a headache that lasted a month and a half, and I was worried there actually might be something wrong with my brain. So, like, when I saw this...
He was like, the bad news is you're going to die.
Yeah, and he was always like, yeah. And then when I got... I had a head CT done, and he called me and he said, like, I'm okay. And I called to say that you're okay. And, like, he was saying, like, which is great, but, like, you know, he's such an odd person. And Sashiel and Lyra... I mean, they weren't based on people. I mean, like, they were in, I mean, personality-wise, they weren't based on people. They were just kind of based on this idea of, like, this concept of tough love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they were inspired by, I would say, I had this ex-girlfriend who was, you know, like, the way that they're described in the book is, like, being, like, very, like, blonde and beautiful and slender, and so is she.
Uh-huh.
And she had an identical twin sister.
Yeah,
which, you know, like, and people don't believe me when I tell them that. I'm like, no, seriously, this actually existed. You know, people think it's made up. And just, like, seeing the sight of the two of them together is pretty mind-expanding.
Yeah.
And I remember I used to think that, you know, like, they should be in a movie or something. You know, like, because it's like, oh, my God, look at these beautiful twins. It's, like, it's so amazing.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, that relationship went the way of all things. And so, like, I was writing... When I got to the point about two-thirds of the way through the book, I saw something that reminded me of her. And I remember thinking about the whole, like, movie idea, and I realized, you know what, I'm not making a movie, but I'm writing a book. So how about I'll create these two, you know, like, these two beautiful blonde characters who are identical.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, personality-wise, they're, like, nothing like the two people in real life. But they were kind of, like, you know, inspired.
Yeah. How regimented was your writing process? Did you have, like, every morning from 9 to 7, or was it just, like, when you were able to write, you wrote? Tell me a little bit just about the writing process.
Most of it was the schedule that I normally kept was at night, 9 to 11 was my writing time. And this is something else that I got from Stephen King's book. He talks about getting a daily goal and sticking to it.
Mm-hmm.
So... And he writes 10,000 words a day.
Yeah.
And he knows, you know, not people can. That's a lot for most person. So he suggests something which he felt is easy, which is 1,000 words a day. And I thought, that's a little too much for me also.
Yeah.
So the goal that I set for myself was 500 words a day, five times a week.
Yeah.
And I stunned myself by actually sticking to it. And if I ever missed a day, you know, like if I was out or something, you know, like I would double up on the next day.
Nice.
And so I kept that pace up, you know, like 3,500 words, you know, like a week, and until like, you know, 6 months later, I had a full manuscript.
Amazing.
Yeah. I didn't actually believe that I could be, have that kind of like self-dominance or like self-discipline rather.
Yeah.
And I actually did it.
But you had a story to tell.
Yeah.
This
I had a story that I liked exploring. So like it's, I felt like it was a joy to always come back and work with these characters.
Which he talks about. He says, yes, it's hard, but it shouldn't feel like work.
Yeah.
If it feels like work, maybe you shouldn't be writing. Maybe you should go be a telemarketer or something. And this is Ink and Worm. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. And we're broadcasting live out of the Velo Bike Shop. Quick summary of events happening this week. There's a couple of exhibitions at the Central Branch of the Library ending on January 24th. The Secret Life of Books and Coney Island Dreams. So if you feel inclined to see those. At McNally Jackson Books, there's a literature book club, 7 p.m. on the 4th. On the 5th, Storycraft is going to be at the Arlington Branch of the Library at 10 a.m. Kate Axelrod and Marion Thurm are going to talk about their book, The Laws of Loving Others, at Book Court, 7 p.m. on the 5th as well. 6th, there is a Storytime sing-along at Housing Works, 10:30 a.m. if you have kiddos. Sounds like fun. And that there's going to be a Gotham Writers open house both Wednesday night and Thursday night from 7 to 9:15. So you can go check out what classes they have, kind of talk to the instructors. Could be fun. There might be booze and food. There might not be. I don't know. Sometimes there are at these things. It's always a nice surprise. You're like, yes.
Let's hope.
I'm going to hope. On the 7th, Colin Beavan is talking about How to Be Alive, Guide to Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. It is an event that costs money, and it's at St. Joseph's College at 7 p.m. There's a comedy show at Housing Works at 7 on the 7th, and some readings happening at McNally Jackson's on the 7th at 7. A few more days. Michael Ian Black is talking about navel gazing, 7 p.m. on the 8th at Book Court. On the 9th, Storytime is happening at Greenlight Books at 11. And then at Book Court, Andrea DeQuino is talking about Alice's Ventures in Wonderland at 2 p.m. And that sums up our week. There's an event at the library, but it's sold out. So you can go and if you really care about Garry Kasparov, you can go
Kasparov.
See if you can sneak in. So I like to end my shows with rapid fire. Bunch of questions. If the answer is I don't know, then that's fine.
Okay.
We could go on from one question and just get through one or two questions, or we can go through them all. I don't have attachment to any outcome. First,
see how it goes.
First question.
The lightning round, I guess. Yeah.
First question is, what book have you not gotten around to reading?
A lot. I actually, and maybe this is a bad thing to say as a writer, I enjoy writing more than I enjoy reading, so I probably don't read as much as I should. There's probably a whole lot of Christopher Moore books that I should have read that I haven't. Probably Sacre Bleu, because I actually bought it when I went to his book signing, and I still have never read it.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
I think that, I just stopped buying books in general because I just had piles and piles of books that I wasn't reading. I was like, I'll just, yeah.
Libraries are your friend.
Libraries, because then if I don't, it's kind of like a self-gauge. If I don't read it by the time it's due, I'm probably not going to read it right then. So I can give it back and revisit in a year or two. What book do you remember your parents reading to you?
My parents never read to me, as far as I remember. I remember my sister buying me a copy of James and the Giant Peach.
Oh, good one.
And I think I was maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 at the time, and I couldn't believe that she had gotten me a book.
Like disgusted or?
Yeah, I was horrified. I mean, like I was a little kid. I wanted, you know, I got toys and I was like, you bought me a book. And I actually sat down and read it begrudgingly. And as soon as I was like a couple pages in, I absolutely loved it.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
Definitely a classic for a reason.
Thinking about that, my sister here, Swan, bought me Fablehaven, which kind of got me into reading.
Yeah. So, Fablehaven is so much fun. If you want to have fun reading, read Fablehaven. So we talked about the 9 to 11, 500 words. Are there any other rituals or routines that are related to your writing?
Probably not. I mean, I always make sure I have something to drink, you know, maybe get like a big double gulp of Coca-Cola when I sit down.
Yeah, better than coffee.
Yeah. And well, you know, like I always I have to have music on. I can't write in dead silence.
Interesting.
And usually it's instrumental music because if I start singing along with something, then I'm going to get distracted.
The lyrics, and,
yeah, it can't be stuff with, you know, like high pitches are bad, so like saxophone jazz is bad, piano jazz is good. And I do also noise rock that I enjoy. Like there's a band called Lightning Bolt, which is almost entirely instrumental and very loud. And they're especially effective if I'm going outside my apartment to write. Like if I'm sitting down in Starbucks and I just want to completely eliminate like all the background noise. It's just like, you know, that'll do
there
it.
There it is. Awesome. And was there a book you read that influenced your transition into puberty?
Into puberty.
Just like in your formative years, there was like a book that kind of changed things or
changed
resonated
the way you saw
with you.
Or helped you grow.
I don't know if I could say that. I mean, I will say that I think the first book that I was assigned to read for school, you know, and this is when I was in middle school, that I actually enjoyed was probably To Kill a Mockingbird.
Huh.
That was a book that I finished, you know, every other book I had said, you know, they tell you, I read this chapter by Tuesday. Like, I read that chapter by Tuesday. This book I just completely absorbed and just like blew through it because I enjoyed it so much.
Hey, so I think the first book that was like that for me was Tuck Everlasting.
Uh-huh.
She was like, read to here. Don't read past. And I was like, you can't tell me what to do. I need to know what happens. How do you find the books that you read? It sounds like you're selective. So is it recommendations or?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, I mostly, like, I'll go through phases. I mean, like, I went through my Stephen King phase. Mm-hmm. And I think the Kurt Vonnegut phase was just I'd heard, you know, like that this was good, and so I started with Slaughterhouse-Five, and I really enjoyed that. So then I went through, you know, like Cat's Cradle and Breakfast of Champions, which is like one of my all-time favorite books. And Christopher Moore was just—I was walking through a bookstore and I saw a book called You Suck, and I picked it up. I said, like, I have to know what this is about, and it's like, you know, like it's a satirical comedy fantasy about vampires. And I read that, and it wasn't until, like, after I read it because, like, that I found out that it's actually the sequel to a book that he'd written 10 years earlier. So I read that book, and then the third book came out, and then I read a couple more of his. Nice. And you know, sometimes on Amazon, you know, like, people who bought this, bought that, things like that.
Nice. Maybe we talked about this already, but what is the best writing advice you've been given?
So the stuff about unearthing the fossil, definitely.
Yeah.
And one thing that we didn't talk about that was in Stephen King's book is don't use adverbs.
Yes.
And that was something that I'd never heard of before. And it makes, I mean, for those not familiar with the concept, Stephen King talks about how, like, it's too quick and easy way to exemplify the action.
It's a cop-out. And
so sometimes you have to. I mean, like, there's a few adverbs in there, but for the most part, I really avoid them. It makes your language so much richer if you don't do that. Yeah. And, like, it's really amazing how just keeping that in mind will enhance what you're doing.
Great. Leaving listeners with a takeaway. This comes from Stephen King's book on writing. He doesn't give a lot of exercises, but he does give one, and he builds up to it. So if you have a chance to actually read the book, it's going to be better than me summarizing. But it basically goes into this detailed tale of a typical abused woman whose husband was put in jail, and then she's driving home from dropping her kid off and, like, gets a weird feeling and brushes it off, and then is home listening to the TV and sees that there was a jail breakout and they caught two of the people, but there's still one inmate at large. And all of a sudden she smells the hair gel that her husband used. And then he's like, and then flip it. So the woman is the one in jail who just escaped, and the husband is the one at home about to be maybe attacked. We don't know. You write. You tell us what happens. So that's from Stephen King's book on writing. And I read a lot of books about writing, and I would highly recommend this one.
Oh, you enjoyed that one?
Yeah. Fantastic. And I'm inspired to read Stephen King now, which I've always been afraid of because I don't want to be scared. But not all of his books are explicitly scary.
Yeah. Well, I also enjoyed the autobiographical like aspect of his book.
Especially the
process of writing Carrie.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's one of my favorite books of all time, like, even though it's not the best written book.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, thank you for having me.
Brother, for letting me drag you along.
You're quite welcome.
Up next, we have Empty Orchestra, exploring the dynamic relationship between song, singer, and the context of karaoke with Angelica and Amanda.
And can I just plug my site before I go?
Yeah.
So, like, if you want to learn more, all right, if you're interested in buying the book, you can go to iamtheangel.com, which is also, I Am the Angel's blog. So it's the main character's blog.
And I'll put all that in the show notes for anybody interested. And again, this was a really fun book. I was surprised how much I liked it. I like you as a person, so I thought I'd like it. But I was surprised how much I liked it.
I was kind of worried, you know, if you were going to be like,
nothing to talk about. No, it was very good, and a lot of really great themes. And I will leave you at the word, take it or leave it, nefarious.